Tonight's guest on Here's a Pioneer is an old-timer of the country that I can remember ever since I came around here, I believe, Heine Snyder. Heine, you are a pioneer and a very active one at that. How long have you been in the territory?
Well, I've been in the territory of Alaska, Jack, since 1909, which makes it 39 years.
39 years. Well, you're eligible to be a pioneer then, aren't you?
Yes, I belong to the pioneers of Alaska, and I had the honor to be president of that organization, and I am Grand Chaplain of the Grand Lodge of Pioneers of Alaska, which goes to show that I not only can tell funny stories, but that I can pray too.
Well, tell me, Heine, did you come up here for the gold rush, or how did you happen to come to the territory?
Well, Jack, I used to be a gentleman that traveled either by a side door pullman or as a steward on the boats. And I came to Alaska in 1909 as a steward on the old steamer Dolphin. Mm-hmm. Just to go out and find out what the country looked like.
You were a seafaring man before you came up here then.
That's right. I was a seafaring man and a sail before the mast.
You were sailing before the mast on the old sailing boats?
Yes.
You came up here on a steamer, though, then?
I came up on the steamer, but I had one occasion that I sailed on an Italian sailing ship, the Esmeralda, a bark from South America, Kalastinay to Russia, 84 days, as an ordinary seaman, yeah.
Well, now tell us a little bit about coming up to this country. What did you do, jump ship?
Well, practically I did, but in the here in America, in that time, you could sign on at a certain port, in an American port, and sign off at another port. So when I came in Skagway, why, I just left the ship with my payroll.
Those were the days when people got off at Skagway and went inside over the trail.
Yeah, I walked over the White Pass and Yukon Route and got a small boat and on Lake Labarge and floated down the river, the Yukon River, to Dawson.
Mm-hmm. Did you work... Let's see, 1909. Was that when the gold strike was going on?
Some of the main gold strikes already were over then, Jack. Mm-hmm. But we had, the time I was a waiter on these river boats, on the old Swatka and so on, we had a new strike there. They called it the Shoshana Gold Strike.
Mm-hmm.
And I deserted ship there and just took in the strike into the Shoshana.
How'd you make out on the mining?
Oh, the mining was not too bad. Have a few friends here that live in Anchorage that still remember me. One of them is Jack Allman, and the other one is our good judge, Anthony J. Diamond. Mm-hmm. He also was there as prosecuting attorney, if I remember well.
Well, how did you happen to leave the interior of the gold mines for the banana belt down around Anchorage here?
Well, I was looking for gold, and I didn't make a great deal in mining. I worked for a fellow by the name of Henshaw, and I made a little money, and it was just about that time the First World War started out, so I was going and join the Boyle's contingent to go overseas and fight the Kaiser. Mm-hmm. I went to Spokane, Washington, and I had an aunt there, and I took this money and I sent for the best gold mine I have ever possessed, which is the present Mrs. Snyder.
Oh, you didn't go overseas then?
I didn't go, no. I was disqualified on some injuries I have received in the war in West Africa. Mm-hmm.
In other words, if you couldn't fight in Europe, you decided to get married and do it right here.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we didn't have much fights.
Well, then you brought Mrs. Snyder back to Alaska. You'd made up your mind to live here then.
Yes, in 1915, or 16 rather, I landed here on where Anchorage is now, on the Mud Flats with Mrs. Snyder. And I worked in several positions or jobs on the Alaska Railroad as a section boss. And I was resigned by request on one occasion, and I started fur farming, and I made pretty good. And at present time, I'm interested in some good gold property in the Willow Creek District, the High Grade Gold Mining Corporation, of which my partner Al Dotson, who is at the present time lessee of the Fern Mine, is also vice president of.
Is that where you settled down to raise your family up in the valley?
Yeah, that is where we raised the family. We had four children, as you know, Jack, probably. We lost our only son, Lincoln Peter, but we have three daughters, and we have 10 grandchildren, almost 11.
For heaven's sake. No great-grandchildren yet.
No great-grandchildren yet, but someday we hope to see them, too.
You're looking forward to that.
Yes.
Well, I imagine in those days, well, even now, for that matter, that territory up around Wasilla really offers a lot, doesn't it, in the way of you have... farming up there, you have game, I presume, and gold mining. Must be a pretty nice place up there.
It sure is. I was surprised myself. I came over yesterday on the train, And when I seen all these wheat fields down there loaded with oats and wheat and hull as barley, I'm surprised to see that we have such a wonderful country. Fishing, of course, the fishing industry, as far as the lake goes and the creek goes, is we should kind of protect it a little bit more by not fishing too extensively, like in the summertime by boat and in the wintertime through the ice and in the spring on the rivers and in the creeks, because that's burning the candles on both sides, I'm afraid.
Well, I don't know. My experience up there has been kind of sad, Heine. I think you're a good man to ask about that. You know, on the road out to Kinnick, this lake, not Lucille, there's a lake beyond that on the road.
Lucille?
No, the one beyond that. It might be Lucille. Anyway, I've been up there fishing several times, and in the evening, you can see that lake just boil with fish jumping, and I haven't caught a single one. I could never catch a fish out of that lake.
Well, maybe you're a poor fisherman, but I know they've been catching fish right there, right and left. And it is too bad that these things exist, but then when civilization comes, these other benefits like we used to have, all the ducks we could shoot and all the grouse we could shoot and all the fish we could catch, why, that has to pass away. Mm-hmm. For in these days, Jack, you remember, we used to have a candle for light. Mm-hmm. And we had a Yukon stove, and that was made sometimes out of 2 5-gallon cans. And now we have an electric stove, and when we get up at night, we don't have to stumble over a chair or a box, because all we do is pull on a string and get a little electric light.
Do you sometimes wish for the old days, Heine?
Well, in one way, it wasn't too bad, but look at the mosquitoes, Jack. The mosquitoes were terrific in these days. Now, where are the mosquitoes? Why, when civilization comes, they'll have to go, too.
I wondered about that, too. I've been gone for some time and come back, and no mosquitoes. I didn't get a single bite all summer. Maybe civilization's all right.
I know some of the Cheechakers, they still holler about mosquitoes, but as far as I know, I haven't seen any. Mm. Not as in big droves as we used to fight them. No, I think Alaska's going to be all right, and we'll have to have a population, and some of them go back, kind of probably disgusted, but the best always stay.
And there'll be a lot more
staying. Oh, yes, there'll be more coming.
Tell me, Heine, you mentioned that you have some gold property up there, and you also mentioned you were in Africa. Did you do any gold mining down there, or was this your first experience when you came to Alaska?
Yeah, my first experience in mining was a placer mining down in the Yukon Territory. Mm-hmm. And the mining that we're doing now is quartz mining in the Willow Creek District. Mm-hmm. But owing to the high prices of material and powder and such, you know, and labor, why, mining is somewhat in the discard. Mm-hmm. But I believe that in the near future, why, the Willow Creek District will come to in its own. Mm-hmm. Because there are a great number of good mining properties there. And maybe sometime a corporation or a big company will come over and unite all these little claims and big properties together and make one great big company out of it. And I believe there is going to be a lot of work for man and woman here in the territory, in this part of the territory of Alaska.
It's a lot different than when you first came up.
Tell
me something. What did your wife think of the country when you landed out here in the mud flats in 15, 16?
Well, you know, Jack, it is a blessing that Mrs. Snyder doesn't talk as much as I do, for then you couldn't live in the same house. She does a lot of thinking, and she don't say much. I, however, want to say this. If I somebody says once in a while to me, "Heine, you're a pretty good man," well, I ought to say, if I am a good man, it is really through the efforts of Mrs. Snyder to keep me kind of on the narrow way. She hasn't got a great deal to say, which is true, but she's been a wonderful mother to our children, and she also always worked in the garden with me, and she has never made any complaints. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we men like always to put all the glory about opening up the territory of Alaska upon ourselves. But I really believe that the woman should have the greatest share of it.
I often wonder what some of the wives thought about Anchorage in this country when they first saw it before there was a town.
Jack, I'd like to just tell you just one thing. We lived here outside of Anchorage on the mud flats. And on one occasion down there, Mrs. Snyder informed me that she had to go to the doctor. And it was on the 26th of January. It was very cold, it was snowing and blowing, and we wanted to go up to the hospital. In fact, it was a very natural cause. She was going to have a baby. And coming down was the dog team, of which I only had one dog at that time. We came to the bottom of 4th Avenue and C Street. The dog couldn't pull anymore, and I couldn't push anymore. Now remember, folks, that is the time, Jack, when there wasn't very many people in this place. Mm-hmm. And it was about 6 o'clock in the morning. And when I come down to the bottom, I says, Alice, I says, it's impossible for me to push the sled anymore, and the dog is all in. Do you think you can walk, or will you stay in the sled down here, and I'll see that I get a doctor or a nurse to come and get you. No, she says, I can make it. And, Jack, there's one thing I'll never forget, because it was 15 minutes past 6 when Mrs. Snyder arrived in the hospital, and it was just exactly 6:30 when our baby boy was born. And that's some credit to a woman who have all the courage through snowstorms and everything to bring another Alaskan into the world, I think.
Was that when you were living here then, or up in Wausau?
No, I was living down here in Anchorage, Jack, mm-hmm. outside of Anchorage, there on the mud flats in a little tent house.
Mm-hmm. What year was that?
That was in 1916.
In 1916?
Yes. Mm.
They had the government hospital here then.
They had the government hospital where it stands now. That mm. is, it is now made into a boarding house or a hotel or something like that here on the corner of C Street.
I was reading when I was outside last winter. I know you're a railroad man. I understand you had a pretty interesting job here last winter laying the tracks on Fifth Avenue.
Yeah, that was a funny proposition. Of course, it was all in fun, you know, but that was, I don't want to say the worst. It was in one way the worst, but some way the best crew I've ever had. They were bankers, and they were grocery clerks, and there was executives of the airplane companies. And one of our greatest troubles is always to see that they don't kill each other. Mm-hmm. You see, when they start spiking on that railroad down there, why, if they miss the spike, well, they just simply turn around and try it from another direction. Forgetting that maybe behind them stood another man down there doing the same thing. So I had to be in a hurry and grab his hammer, or else he hit somebody on the cocoa down there. But it was a wonderful experience.
Well, Heine, you've been around the world. You've been around Alaska a lot. You've seen a lot of the country. Are you settling down here now, or do you think your homestead up in Wausau is going to be your ultimate aim?
Well, Jack, I've worked this summer for the Alaska Road Commission. Mm-hmm. Although I'm supposed to be retired, but I always run short of money. And
that's a very common failing.
Yeah, and I was getting a little bit too fat. So the doctor told me to kind of reduce a little bit. So I went to the road commission. Mr. King gave me an axe and told me to go at it. Well, I lost 20 pounds, and I got over $1,000. And with that money, I bought some logs, and I'm going to build our dream house.
Oh, you are? Up on your lake at Wausau?
Yes, on the lake. I'm 62 years old, and I don't want to say how old the missus is, but we have always wanted some kind of a log house overlooking that lake whereby we have spent our last years in peace, and instead of all these small talks that goes on in the different little towns.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have a wonderful spot, a beautiful place up there, Heine, and I hope you get that dream house built and you'll invite me up for a cup of coffee sometime.
Well, we surely will, Jack.
And I want to thank you very much. We're running out of time now, Heine. I want to thank you very much for coming up and talking to us. We're a little short, so good luck to your dream house.
Thank you very much, Jack. It's been a pleasure to me to come over here. And anytime I can say something good about Alaska, you know you can find me.
I do.
Thank you.
Wednesday evening at 7:30 is time for Here's a Pioneer. It's a weekly presentation of the Pioneer Cab Company, an interview with one of Alaska's genuine old-timers. The Pioneer Cab Company, you know, is located across from the Nordale Hotel in the center of town. And their number, for your convenience, 24 hours a day, is East 10A. Now, this week we are particularly happy to have as a studio visitor Mr. Edward Keyes. Mr. Keyes, I think I'll begin by asking you how old you are.
87.
You're 87 years of age, and that really makes you one of Alaska's genuine oldsters. Now, what part of Alaska do you call home?
Fairbanks.
Fairbanks is your home, but you have mining property around here, don't you?
Yes, I have up in the hills.
Mm-hmm. And are you a member of the Pioneers of Alaska?
I am.
I see. And have you visited them recently?
Yes, just last evening at the monthly session.
I see. I imagine that it was a happy time there rejoining and exchanging experiences with some of your old friends.
Yes, it was. Very happy. Mm-hmm. Very enjoyable.
I'm going to ask you to retrace briefly. First of all, let's see, what was your home down in the States, Mr. Keyes?
Altoona, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. Did you live at Altoona all the time?
Yes, practically all the time after I was about 12 years old.
Mm-hmm. Then did you move west?
I decided to go out west. There was a depression there, and in the shops, a great many were laid off, and I decided to go out west to an uncle who lived in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. And then you moved from Minnesota out to...
From Minnesota, I learned of the need for railroad employees on the railroad, and I moved farther west to Bismarck, mm-hmm. North Dakota.
Then eventually you moved out to Seattle, isn't
out
that right?
To Glendive.
Uh-huh. Where's that, near Seattle?
That's in Montana.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived there running train for a number of years, railroad man for 11 years, conductor.
Well, what about this turning point to Alaska? That's what I want to know about. When did you decide to come north?
I decided to come north along in the year, four part of the year of 96. And I had met an old friend who had been up here, and I was much interested in his story of what opportunities there were there in Alaska. And I got hold of a man who had a desire to go at the time, a young man, and we started north in March 1896.
And what boat did you come up on?
The old steamer Mexico. We landed at Dyea and unloaded the freight there by lighters or barges, mm-hmm. no wharfs. And from there, we hauled our supplies, our goods. We had the two Yukon sleds, hauled them up to Sheep Camp.
Oh, yes.
As an intermediate station between the summit of White Pass and Dyea, about halfway, as I imagine.
What time of the year was that?
That was along in the latter part of March.
In March.
Latter part of March.
Of 96.
Of 96.
Uh-huh. And how was traveling at that time? What did you do, take the stuff in relays?
Yes, we had to... the only method that we had, we freighted it or hauled it on sleds up as far as Sheep Camp. From there, it was steeper, and most of them packed it, a 100-pound pack on their backs. Mm-hmm. Well, I decided that was a little hard, and that there would be an easier way by hauling it on the sled, because you could ride back on that sled and make a quicker trip.
You were looking for the free ride.
Yes.
How did that work out?
Oh, it worked out fine. And my partner would follow me, and when I'd slow down, he was instructed to use his brake, a stick, which would stick down through the slats of the sled against the crossbar. And it worked all right, with the exception of one fellow one day. It was a very comical incident, but it might have been serious. He was sitting down to rest, and just as I got within about 100 feet of him, he rose suddenly and started to come. And I was going pretty fast and didn't have sufficient room for to check myself, and I just could steer on the trail sufficiently good, close, so that I just went between his legs, and it tipped him over back onto me, and we both went about 200 or 300 feet before I could stop the sled. He was very much worked up about it, but I reasoned with him and showed him that it was his fault.
Mm-hmm.
And so dismissed the incident, and we got to be good friends.
I see. Well, now after you went up the pass, down the other side, and down to those lakes, how did you make out?
We went along on till we struck the lakes, where it was smooth ice with the exception of occasional drifts. And I had been a pretty good sailor in my boyhood days. Ice yacht and a boat. in the summertime, nice shot in the winter. So I rigged up a sail and got a straddle of the load, and it worked fine. Went, made probably 15, 20 mile an hour, good stiff wind.
Oh, yes.
And could steer it by the sail, pulling it right or left.
Well, that must have been the easy way of traveling.
The easy way. It was thrilling also. It was very enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. Now, when did you change from that mode of transportation to something else?
As soon as we got to where the water was partly open, we camped and built what we call a whipsaw pit, and whipsawed our, fell our trees and whipsawed the lumber. You've heard probably some stories about how some of them were so skillful that they could make this big high platform and then fall the trees on it and start the whipsaw. Well, that's fantastic. I never see anybody do that, and I don't think that it happened.
Yeah. Well, did you have any difficulty with whipsawing the lumber for your boat?
Oh, yes, a little. The man underneath and whipsawing, he always imagines that he's got the worst of it. In this case, my partner had asthma, and he had to dress very heavily. He had heavy clothing on, sweaters, and heavy blanket-lined vest, and such things, trousers, blanket-lined, and I, in addition to him. Pulling up the saw, I frequently had to haul up a portion of his weight. He'd get kind of, it stiffened him up for to have so much clothes on. And I finally stopped and I said, Arthur, or Oscar, I don't object to pulling my share of this saw up back on the backstroke, but, and also, won't kick if I just have an ordinary portion of your weight. But I says, with all those clothes on, I says, it's asking too much. And I says, I don't want to go through that. You better take off some of those clothes. So he finally compromised, wanting to work up where I was, and I changed off with him and went a little better.
I see. Well, how did you make out going through the rapids? You're here with us tonight, so I suppose that everything went all right.
Those rapids are very straight. Mm-hmm. That's called the Miles Canyon. Mm-hmm. They're very straight. And if a man is skillful with the oars, the middle of the water course is a rounding, kind of a comb forms. And if you ride in the center, handle your oars properly, and the man in the steering, the stern, handles the paddle properly, or the rudder, why, you can keep in that middle, and as long as you keep in the middle, you're safe. Mm-hmm. If you have a good boat, you're safe. And my partner didn't seem to understand, and he got nervous and kept looking around, and it made it pretty serious. We couldn't. We each had an oar on the middle and then the man steering behind. So I says, Oscar, I says, don't keep looking behind, but just pull a steady, strong stroke.
And that's what took you through?
That's what took us through in good shape.
Now, you said that your eventual destination was Circle City. Did you stop up Dawson Way on the way to Circle City?
Yes, we stopped at an island and cut timber and made a raft of good logs for to take down with us to Circle City for to build a cabin when we got there. An old-timer that we'd got acquainted with on the trail advised us that that was a good plan. When we got to Circle, why, we changed our mind about building and we sold the logs to a party that was glad to get them and went out to the creeks. We packed all our freight from there out through the tundra, swamps, millions of mosquitoes, but there was one little incident that was very interesting to me. That was the midnight sun. We see that global ball of apparently red fire rolling along the horizon for 2 or 3 hours at midnight when it was low, and then the bright, when it got higher up, the bright, hot sun later on. So it was quite a novelty, and I enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. You know, your original intention in coming up here, I suppose, was to find gold. How did you make out in the mining game?
We went up to Crooked Creek. It's called Crooked Creek now, but at that time it was dubbed Hog'em Creek because a man by the name of Barker had went out there with his wife and daughter and two dogs. And he was the first one to land there, and he staked a claim for himself, one for his wife, one for his daughter, and one for each of the dogs. So they called it Hog'em Creek.
Where have you done most of your mining?
Did most of the mining up first in the Klondike and later on around Fairbanks.
Mm-hmm. Have you handled dog teams to a great extent?
I've handled dog teams quite a bit and kept seven dog teams, seven dogs to the team.
Mm-hmm.
Two abreast until they come to the leader, and that leader was alone in the front.
Mm-hmm. Would you mind recalling the incident in regard to a leader that belonged to a Frenchman that you met on the trail?
When I heard the news of the strike up in Klondike, I decided that I would go up. It was a 300-mile trip in the spring. I loaded up my sled with supplies and started out. And on the way, I was young and husky, and I had rigged up a sail to help me when the wind was on the back, and I overtook a freighting outfit, a man, a Frenchman, by the name of Moon. He used to freight on the 40 mile, and he had a dog team, five dogs, and I got ahead of him and made good time, and I would got far enough ahead that I'd have a lunch and invite him to have a cup of coffee with me, partake, join me. And he wound up by saying, well, if you do that, I will loan you a dog. And I says, if you do that, I'll take 100 pounds of your load. So I took 100 pounds of sugar and went along making good time, but the poor dog had been abused so much. He had three broken ribs and was blind in one eye and couldn't see out of the other. So I had pity on the dogs. I liked dogs. And I would pick the dog up and put him on the sled and pull the sled and the dog too for 2 or 3 or 4 miles. That didn't suit Bone. He said that I'd spoil the dog. So I challenged him to sell the dog to me, but he didn't want to do that. And so he said he was going to camp there, and I turned the dog back to him. And I'd started out when I heard the dog howling, and I looked back, and he was beating him with a shovel. I dropped everything and went back, running back, and just caught the shovel in time to avoid him probably giving the dog a wind-up blow that would put him out of business entirely.
Mm-hmm. I see. Well, Mr. Keyes, I wish that we had 3 or 4 hours instead of just 15 minutes in which to review your experiences here in the North Country. We've certainly enjoyed your visit to the KFAR studios. Friends, you've listened to another program of Here's a Pioneer, and this week's genuine old-timer has been Mr. Edward Keyes, who has mining property in the Bonnefield country and calls Fairbanks his home. This program is brought to you each Wednesday evening at 7:30 by the Pioneer Cab Company, stand located at the Nordale Hotel. The telephone number is East 10A. Now it's time for Pioneer Cab to bring you Here's a Pioneer, regular weekly Wednesday night presentation featuring an interview with one of Alaska's real old-timers. Tonight we'll suffice it to say that the Pioneer Cab, that means manager Joe Coble and the entire staff, want to wish one and all of you the happiest kind of a new year. Tonight's interview consists of 15 minutes of conversation with one of Alaska's real old-timers, and I think this also applies to Yukon Territory. His name is Alex Capewell, a well-known local figure. And, Mr. Capewell, I'm going to begin the interview by asking you when you came to Alaska. You came to Alaska in what year was that? Do you recall?
1897 and 98.
I understand that you began for Alaska some point way down in Montana.
Yes, Belt, Montana.
How did you get up in this country? Did you come by boat?
No, come with the horses.
That would seem to me to be the hard way. Why didn't you come by boat? That would be a lot easier.
Oh, well, we just come in the short way.
I see you were saving on space, but eventually I suppose you did not save on time.
No.
Uh-huh. Well, we'd like to know a little bit more about that trip. You started from Belt, Montana, and how many people were there in the party, Mr. Capewell?
There was five from Belt. We picked up others on the way. They were used to be in Belt. There was myself and Joe Doughty, Dave Davis, Bob Lamb, and Joe Lamb, and Jack Schultz.
Did you have a great number of hardships on that trip, traveling by horse? I suppose you had to cross many streams.
Yes, we had to swim when we come to the big rivers.
How long did it take you to make that trip?
15 months.
15 months in traveling from Montana to Dawson. That was your final destination.
Yes.
Any particular tragedies or real experiences that stand out vividly in your memory?
Yes, we lost a man out of the outfit in the Liard River. His name is Butler, Jim Butler. The boat got away from him. There was 19 men on the line. He was coming through Cranberry Rapids, and the boat got a run on him, started out and turned over, threw him into the river.
I understand that that was a story that was repeated many times in the old days, loss in the particularly wild rivers of the north. Now, will you tell us something of the route that you chose to come? I suppose it was a completely unblazed trail, if you could call it that.
Well, we left Belt and come to Great Falls, and we swam the Missouri River just below the mouth of the Sun River, where Sun River comes in. And we went up by Freezeout, Shoto, across the Blackfoot Reserve, and swam the Belly River, and the old man's headed for McLeod. Then from McLeod we went to Calgary. From Calgary up to Edmonton, it was pretty well settled. Otherwise, there was no settlement between Calgary and Fort McLeod at that time. There was no fences then. After we left Edmonton, there was no fences from then on. We come across the Peminaw River and the Athabasca, and went through the Swan Mountains over to Little Narrows at Little Slave Lake. Then from there, there was a 90-mile pretty good road over to Peace River, called it Peace River Crossing. I don't know why they called it a crossing. There was nothing there, only a big river. We swam the river there and went up the north side of that, past Dunvegan, onto Fort St. John. We took wagons as far as Fort St. John. That's the first wheel that ever rolled into Fort St. John. But Fort St. John didn't stand where it does now. All there was there was a Hudson Bay post down on the river bar, and the banks is very high. The Indians was camped on top. We went from there to Hudson's Hope. We couldn't get through. Country too rough. We come back and then struck northwest for the Finley River. Passing through the mountains there, we turned due south there for about a half a day. I thought he was coming back, but we finally found a pass through the mountains. Followed the Finley up and then crossed from there up Fox. Just where it is, I don't know. I'd like to know where it was when we crossed. It's cost me lots of time and money trying to find that place.
You mean you're not sure now exactly which way you did go?
No, there's a prospect there that I've been looking for.
Well, it's generally understood now that you're one of the men who pioneered the trail that eventually became the Alaska Highway. Would you agree with that? No doubt you did follow, to a certain extent, the same route.
No. We left that at Fort St. John, and we went up the Halfway River. Then you see we're south of the present route, and we come and cross it again at the Liard River at the lower post, which is mile 620 now.
I see.
On the highway.
You wintered along the trip. You didn't come through in one season.
No, we wintered at the head of the Big Muddy.
You built a cabin there at the head of the Big Muddy?
Yes.
And what did you do during the winter, and how long did you stay there?
We hunted mountain sheep. We won't run out of grub. I had one slice of bread in 3 months there.
What time of the year was it when you finally came into Dawson?
Well, it was end of May.
End of May, and I suppose you were pretty tired and pretty ragged by then.
Well, it was all rags. I had a pair of shoes there. They were Sergeant and Pinsky there had a store in Dawson. They wanted to buy them shoes and send them back to the man that made them. They was mostly wyvern babbish.
Now, I'd like to have you tell us how many of your party got through. There were only, didn't you say two remaining?
Yes, there's only two from that whole bunch come through.
Oh, I see. Well, that's amazing that you got through at all. Tell us a little bit about Dawson at that time. Was it reaching its peak, or was it past its crest, or what was the situation there?
Well, I would say it was just about at its peak. Everybody was busy there, going which way. Everybody had money but those that come in. I was one of them.
Did you stake any claims there in the Dawson area?
Well, I staked one on Lovett Gulch. I did a lot of prospecting, but I didn't stake any particular ground there. The one on Lovett Gulch was the one where there's about 50 of them staked.
How long did you stay in the vicinity of Dawson, Mr. Capewell?
Oh, I'd say about 2 years.
2 years. And then what finally made you move from Dawson?
Oh, it looked greener over the hill. It was a Nome. That Nome stampede come.
That was a big hill, too, because it was a long way over from Nome. How did you travel from Dawson to Nome?
Dog team.
By dog team all the way. How long did that take?
Oh, that was 33 days.
Understand that the airlines are doing a considerably faster job of it now. Will you tell us something of the booming town of Nome? You reached there about at the peak, too, didn't you?
Yes. Oh, it was booming there. The beach diggings was going. There, it was going good. I staked a claim over on Little Creek. It looked too flat. It looked only just like a little trickle of water at that time. So I didn't hold it, but it turned out awful good afterwards.
I suppose somebody else came along and really made a fortune on the ground that you'd originally staked.
Well, a big company come along. Then there was Billy Cummins and John Minogue, friends of mine. They was rocking over on American Gulch. That's over the hill from Dexter. And I was over there visiting. Billy Cummins and I was walking back, and it was raining cats and dogs. And as we crossing Dexter, I said, "Bill, let's stake those benches." And Bill said, "Wait till it quits raining. We'll come back and stake it." Well, when we went back there, there was a trench dug there about 3 foot deep. I could see gold in the bottom of it. I jumped down in and picked up a piece of gold. Said, "Look at the gold, Bill." Fella jumped up with a shotgun and he says, you get out of there." And I got out.
I imagine that would give you plenty of reason for getting out of there in a rush. What other sort of work besides mining did you do around Nome?
Well, the steamer Quickstep was sunk in Snake River. And we hired the steamer Riley and got her alongside of the Quickstep. A man named Whitehead and myself, and we raised the Quickstep. We had the Quickstep just afloat at the time that big crowd come from Seattle with that big barge. I forget what they call her.
Did you see a lot of disappointed people around Nome?
Oh, yes, there was lots of disappointed people. There was a big crowd coming on the boat one day, and a woman reached down and grabbed a handful of sand and shook it through her hand. She turned to her husband and said, "I told you there was no gold here. Look at this. There's no gold here."
It was all his fault for coming all that way. Did you personally locate any really good mining ground at Nome?
Well, no, I didn't have any real good ground. The ground that I wanted, they drove me off with the shotgun, as I was telling you.
I see. When did you leave Nome? And where did you go after that?
We went up to Dawson on the John C. Barr.
I see. Was there another strike at Dawson, or you just felt sort of homesick for
it? No, I got tired of that rabble in Nome. They was just fighting over little pieces of town property, and if you put a stake in, man are liable to shoot you.
I see. It must have been just about the turn of the century when you moved back to Dawson from Nome then.
Well, I just don't remember when it was. It went up the river again. But anyway, I hadn't been in Dawson long before the Fairbanks stampede come. The Jap come up there with the news. I was working at the time, and he come. I was cooking at the time at the Green Tree, and the Jap come in. I went and talked to him, and he said, yes, there's gold there.
I've heard of the Jap, as you say. What was his name, do you know?
Water.
Water. Frank Waddo, wasn't
Frank
it?
Frank Waddo.
Uh-huh. And he's the man who brought the news of the strike on, what creek was it over here, Pedro?
Yes, Pedro.
Uh-huh. He uh-huh. brought the news to Dawson, and I suppose within a matter of a day or two, Dawson was practically evacuated. Is that true?
Oh, well, you know, they don't evacuate, but all the loose ones get out, and them that's got the price and uh-huh. the means.
Well, I imagine that you've seen a lot of exciting times here in Fairbanks since you've been here. What are some of the most exciting?
I don't know. You were speaking about water a minute ago. I'll tell you what happened to water here. When the early days, you know, water was working for Cap Barnett's store. And I heard some fellas talking, said, that doggone water there, he's lying. There's nothing here, no gold here. Said, let's go hang him. So I listened and thought to myself, well, I'll go and try to cut in, try to stop any trouble if it comes. So I followed him into the store. And he walked in and said, hey, Jap, there's no gold here, so we're going to hang you. Jap walked right from around the counter, walked right up in front of him and said, hang, I give a damn.
Well, you know, there's something else I'd like to ask you about, too. You say you've been here for 44 years. At one time, there was a rather serious washout right here in the center of town. Do you happen to know what year that was?
Well, I would judge it somewhere around 6, as near as I can tell. Yes, that was bad. There was 2 bridges here, and the upper bridge went out, and the piling come down and lodged on the bridge about where the bridge stands today. And that turned the current into the bank, and the bank was washing away pretty fast.
It got up as far as the drugstore and under the drugstore, didn't
it? Yes, it was under the corner of the drugstore, 3 foot under the corner of the drugstore.
Well, how did Fairbanks finally get out of that fix?
Well, they sunk a steamer. They sunk a steamer right out in just above the bridge now, about 50 foot above the bridge, but that wouldn't do it. So Cap Langley got his boat and run up the river and tied onto that piling and pulled that piling out, and when he pulled the piling down, that relieved it.
I see. Well, our time is growing short now, Mr. Capewell. I understand, too, that you were one of the operators of the only horse-racing enterprise here in Fairbanks. Where was the park located?
Well, it's over where the F.E. Company stands now.
I see. And at one time, how many people do you imagine you had over there in the grandstands?
Well, we had the whole town there at that time. They just left Fairbanks and went across the river for the race.
And you were a jockey on one of the horses, weren't
you? No, I never did any horse racing. No, I was pulling the marathon races.
How many men did you have in the marathon?
We had 23 starters for one race.
23 starters, and how far did they run?
26 miles, 385 yards.
Well, in those days, I imagine it amounted to a real celebration. That was on the 4th of July, wasn't it?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yes, that was a good day. We took in $5,555 at the gate, and half of them went over the fence. They couldn't get in fast enough.
All right, thank you ever so much, Mr. Capewell. We've certainly enjoyed sitting down with you and talking over old times that you seem to recall so vividly. Our thanks to you again, Alex Capewell, one of Alaska's real old-timers. This has been a presentation of the Pioneer Cab Company in Fairbanks. Each Wednesday night at 7:30, Pioneer Cab brings you a 15-minute discussion recalling the early days with one of the genuine old-timers of the territory of Alaska. And now briefly, we'll say in behalf of the staff and management of Pioneer Cab, the best kind of a Happy New Year, and we'll be with you 1 week from tonight with another presentation of Here's a Pioneer.
Here's a Pioneer. Welcome once again to our weekly quarter hour presented by the Pioneer Cab Company and bringing you the men that know Alaskan history, the men that are willing to talk about it and give us some of the background to a great territory with a great history. The Pioneer Cab Company is a pioneer institution for Fairbanks, known as well for its long-time service as for the courtesy of pioneer cab drivers and for their efficient promptness. You'll be going the right way every time in a pioneer cab. Call East 10. I know you're anxious to hear who we're talking to today. We have talked to him at length before the program, and we know it's going to be interesting. We'd like to introduce you to Bob McKenna. Let's see, he's writing out that full name. R. Mickey, right? R. Mickey McKenna. He has been prominent in the civic and business life of Fairbanks for these many years. Though in years, Mr. McKenna wouldn't suggest an old-timer. He belongs in the circle by right of charter membership. He was born in Alaska. The days of the gold rush are boyhood memories to Bob, I know. The progress of Alaska since parallels his own growing years. But that's enough talk from us. Bob, the beginnings of Alaska to most pioneers are the experiences of grown men. I know that in your case, some of them are those of boyhood memories. So we'd like to start a little beyond you. I'd like to ask you about your folks, when they came to Alaska, when you were born, what their trip was like, just anything that occurs to you about their coming to the territory.
Thanks, Rube. Well, I'll have to think back a little while. The folks come to Alaska in 1886.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, that's a lot of water through Seymour Narrows where we have to all come through.
Oh, where's Seymour Narrows, Bob?
Well, it's a little neck between Vancouver Island and Cape Mudge. That's down about 15 hours run out of Seattle. In the center of it, there's what we call Ripple Rock, which is a very dangerous piece of water to navigate due to the fact that you either have to wait for an ebb tide or a high tide. You've got only about 10 minutes leeway to get through there before she starts boiling.
Uh-huh. Does Seymour Narrows separate the territory from the states? Is that...
No, it doesn't separate the territory from the states, but it does separate Vancouver or Canadian waters from American waters.
Well, that's
it's a controversial... Ripple Rock is supposed to be taken care of between the two governments.
Uh-huh.
And it's in the making right now.
Well, that sounds like a setting for quite a trip, Bob. Your folks ever tell you much about that trip north through there?
Yes, they did. one incident I'll never forget. Coming up on the boat, I forget which of the boats it was, but in 1886, old B.M. Barons and Charlie Goldstein and most of the old-timers were aboard. There was about 120 aboard the boat. And the grub wasn't the best, you know, and so... they formed a committee and waited on the captain and went to the head steward to see if anything could be done to overcome this. They served stew practically every day, and it was served in dishpans. Well, after the committee had waited on the captain, and the next meal was served, why, along comes this rotten stew again. Well, in the crowd was one of my uncles, who weighed, oh, a man weighed around 250 pounds. Well, what did he do? He walked over when they set this pan of stew down, and he picked it up, and he walked over to the waiter and just, zowie, put it right over his head. That's one of the outstanding things that I remember.
That's what you call gastronomical pioneering.
Yes, it was.
Well, they made the journey all right then.
Oh, yes, they all landed. In fact, B.M. Barons, here's a funny incident. B.M. Barons and my dad were partners when they first come to Alaska. My dad went mining and died. He was the first man buried on White Pass coming out before the White Pass and Yukon Railroad was finished.
No.
He followed mining and died practically penniless. B.M. Barons died here a few years ago, owning the banks of the B.M. Barons Bank, Juno, and I guess B.M. was worth $2 million.
Mm-hmm.
It's just how fate turns, you know.
Well, it provided Rex Beach with a lot of material,
yes,
didn't it?
Yes, it did.
When were you born, Bob, and where?
1889 in Douglas. The first boy, and I think that I was the... either the second or third white child born on Douglas Island. Of course, Oliver Anderson, who I called Doc, we always contest that.
Uh-huh.
But Douglas Meade was the first white child born on Douglas Island. He was born at Treadville.
Let's see, did you spend all your boyhood in southeastern Alaska?
Practically, yes. I spent my boyhood days in southeastern Alaska, and then I had charge of the waterfront in 1913 down there. In fact, I had charge of 15 docks and moved to Anchorage in 1917 for the government.
Oh.
And I was going overseas, that's to China with Colonel Mears, but fate changed it the other way, and I'm still in Alaska. I went back and went to work for the Alaska Steamship again.
And you've been a transportation man for a long time, right?
I've been in transportation all my life.
Uh-huh.
I went over for the French government first, but let's see, in 1923, when I was sailing on the Alameda, my wife, who was Theo Kraft at that time, was on the she was on the Oriental run, and I was on the Alaska run, mm-hmm. run to Seattle to Anchorage, and she come over and come on the Alameda with us. I think we're the only ones that was ever worked for the Alaska Steamship as man and wife.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, you're mentioning dates a couple of minutes ago, Bob, and there are some very important ones in the history of Alaska. I know that there are dates that you're familiar with and the occurrences that accompanied them. I think that the 1908 strike is one that stands out in the memories of a lot of old-time Alaskans. You were present.
Yes, it does. For this one reason, is that in 1908, the Treadville Gold Mining Company, which was operating, the biggest low-grade mine in the world, and they used to hire a lot of Serbs. They must have been 900 or 1,000 Serbs at that time, and they had a strike. They didn't really have a union, but they called a strike for better conditions. And each time that one of these men would die, the company would allow them a half day's recreation. And Merle Thomas, who is now in this town right now with the Alaska Airlines, was the undertaker, and I was handling the hearse when one of these men died during the strike, and we went up to the Greek Orthodox Church, and they wouldn't allow us in with the body. So we called the marshals in Juneau and deputized 50 marshals to come over to Douglas and got behind the hearse. Well, they called a riot act, and I took the body out to the graveyard myself. And after, eventually, why, the priest come along and the rest of the pallbearers and all, and we had the services out of the grave, but they would not allow us in the church.
I'd like to know where else that could happen besides Alaska.
No.
That's your outstanding memory of that 8th strike, huh?
Yes, it was.
Well, a couple of years after that, there was a great disaster that's remembered by all old-timers. That was the Mexican mine disaster.
Well, the Mexican mine disaster was the men were all on the 1300 level, I think, when just about dinner time they started and they were waiting for the hoist to take the men up to the top. When it's never been known how it happened, but the powder magazine on the 1300 level was right alongside of the hoist shaft, and for some reason, it exploded and killed every man on that shift.
Is that right?
34 men. The only thing that ever lived through that blast on that level was one mule. He was standing right alongside the magazine. We never could figure out how it did happen.
Well, that's always the case.
Yes.
There's always a mule left.
I'm kind of a jackass. That's how I'm living so long, I guess.
You're mentioning the Treadwell mine and the strike that tied that one up. There was also a great disaster that involved that in the year 1916. That I'm sure that you could tell us about, too.
That was the cave-in,
Rube.
Yes. I think that was the saddest thing that ever hit southeastern Alaska due to this one fact, was that You see, they worked about 1,900 men on the Alaska Treadwell, or the Treadwell Company, and they supported another 3,000 people, which would make it about 5,000 people, and they absolutely depended on the workings of the Treadwell Mine. Well, the Treadwell Mine was what we call a pit operation, and when it run out, clear out over the under the bay, and when it broke and filled, it just absolutely washed everything that the people could, you know, any livelihood that they could see. Yeah. It just took the hearts right out of them. Yeah, it was a sad affair. I think that was a sad affair in the history of southeastern Alaska that happened.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you remember about that great cave-in?
Oh, well, there was incidents, but I don't know if anything particular.
Uh-huh. Well, we seem to have got off on the subject of disasters, Bob. You're a transportation man. And as I recall, I don't recall or anything like that, but I've heard the year 1907 cited as the one that in which there was the wreck of the SS Mauritian. As a transportation man, I imagine that one is close to you, and you remember a good deal about it. The SS Mauritian, you remember?
Yes, I do. Yeah, that's very vivid in my mind today. Well, for this one reason, it was in the days when you didn't have radio. No way of communicating from ship to shore. This ship took out from San Francisco, was going to take the North Channel, that's the Great North Way, and go to China. And for some reason, something broke down, machinery or something, and she drifted in the Pacific for, two and a half months. Now, if you can appreciate this, and I think the Alaskans can, who have traveled back and forth,